You're listening to Underground History, a collaboration between Jefferson Public Radio and the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and each episode we take a deep dive into little-known aspects of history in the region and beyond. I'm joined today by one of my favorite historians, Mark James Carpenter, to talk about the research behind his latest book, The War on Illihi: Genocide, Complicity, and the Cover-ups in the Pioneer Northwest. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
Yeah. So I want to start out by talking about the way that you introduce and frame your book. You're exploring the genocide of settler colonialism, but not just as a historical telling of what happened, but through an interrogation of how these events have been memorialized and historified, if that's even a word, over time. And as you put it, quote, "History writers disagreed over which stories they should tell and which stories they could sell," end quote. And so that not only brings in this layer of erasure, but also the commercialization of violence. So can you start us off by speaking to that a little bit?
Absolutely. Yeah. So this book is a two-parter in a way. That's why it's a bit on the long side. It's both this story of horrific violence that was used to take Oregon and Washington, especially in the 1850s, but from the 1840s through to the 1870s. But as you said, it's an exploration of why that story isn't already known. And one of the surprising things of my research was to find very deliberate, iterative efforts of cover-ups by historians, both kind of on the face of it, saying there are certain kinds of stories that we should tell, but we should rake up no old stories of evil, as one of them put it, but also sort of the way the market interacts with that what people wanted to buy from historians in the late 1800s was stories of pioneers as heroes, and what they didn't want to buy was stories which were honest about the horrors and depth of the violence that had been used to seize land.
Yeah, and you've coined this phrase that I love and I cite all the time, the cozy pioneer history. And I think it really captures some of the issues that you're talking about, where people want to tell the history of the West, and we now are striving for accuracy and have to navigate not only the historical violence of the past, but also trying to mitigate this patina of exaggeration or minimalization that came with this effort to make a good story. And there's really an expected cadence to Western history. And audience have been trained long before Hollywood up to now to expect this particular narrative arc. So how did you start to recognize kind of the tropes or some of the iconic thing? That's that same kind of storytelling. Let me kind of pull that back. What are some of the clues that you track over time?
Yeah, so it started actually with an individual family where there was a family, the Lane family, after which Lane County is named, that had a story of their original Oregon patriarch, Joseph Lane, that was very, very positive and kind of in a cozy pioneer way as a friend of the Indians. And then when I dug in early in the work, I found that Joseph Lane was one of the worst people I've ever read of, who did every kind of violence I can imagine. He's a mass murderer. He's a rapist. And so trying to figure out how they got him wrong led to this sort of broader issue of, oh, this is just family stories over and over again, right? But what was really striking about this that I think is that the cozy pioneer narrative was not the only pioneer narrative that people wanted to lionize. There's this fight early about whether the story of pioneering is essentially, let's say it, Little House on the Prairie, right, where it's this sort of empty land, or whether it's this story of manly violence to seize land from another race. And because there was that early conflict, there's just so much evidence when it comes to what actually happened, because many people wanted to be honored for the violence they inflicted. Where you really see that cozy pioneer narrative come in is in the next generation, right? People talking about their parents and grandparents just edit out more and more and more of the violence, to the point where I joke with my wife, every time I go into an archive, I find the murder before the end of the day, right? Because it's just everywhere once you start digging, even though it's almost nowhere in a popular culture.
Yeah. And, you know, not only were the stories of pioneer violence minimized and twisted, but in covered up, you talked about rape and sexual violence, especially even today, is downplayed or just avoided by historians. And locally, I know there are rumors that the Harris Massacre, which is firmly enmeshed in the Rogue River War literary canon, was a response to sexual violence perpetrated by George Harris. And there's a lot we just aren't going to ever know about what happened, but if you erase a cause, it's really easy to frame the response to meet your narrative needs. So by erasing some of this violence, people can change the way we think about these events.
And that was happening right from the beginning, right? One of the things I show over and over again in the book is this kind of editing out very early of why there was violence from Indigenous people. And often it's a direct response to violence from Euro-Americans, to murders or to sexual violence, right? And by editing that out early, they're able to shape those stories right from the beginning. I'd also say part of the point of the book, part of the scope of the book, that it goes across Oregon and Washington, is so that in individual cases like the Harris case, even when you don't have all the evidence, you can know the norms. So the fact that in this book, I'm able to show broadly that across the Pacific Northwest, there was a pioneer rape culture, that across the Pacific Northwest, there were incidents of sexual violence by pioneers that touched off retributive violence, that can weigh on how we think about the evidence in individual cases.
And that really gets to the concept behind the title of your book, The War on Illihi, which is like not only the individual campaigns, but kind of the broader pattern of how these campaigns, I guess, were fought or organized or not organized and the motivations behind them. Can you speak to that a little bit more, too? Like, I'm thinking in Jacksonville, you know, we had all these bored, out-of-work miners, and they figured out they could get reimbursed to, like, if they were, like, formed these little vigilante armies.
Absolutely, yeah. So the Illihi is a term for homeland from Chinookwa or Chinook jargon. I picked it because it was a term that was known by both Indigenous and pioneer people in this period. You're trying to name a war, I try to at least name it something that would be recognizable. But part of why I have this new name for a new idea of a war is because in the records of both the Indigenous people and the pioneers who fought in it, it was this kind of region-spanning period of violent invasion, and it was a violent invasion at the end of the day for land, right? Sometimes historians now call it land hunger, right? That it's about taking land. But it's also about other forms of money. As you mentioned, there is, particularly in Jacksonville and some of those areas, there's a lot of pecuniary, right, a push for money as part of why you might do violence. What I was finding is that's somewhat more famous in Southern Oregon than elsewhere. It's common across the region, right? Along the Columbia River, there are people who are rubbing their hands with glee at the possibility that there might be more war against local Native people because they want to take their cattle as well as their land, right? Mm-hmm. That's happening far to the north in Washington as well. Right. There's a lot of money and land as the core motivation behind all these pioneer wars, and they're connected. Right. I think the violence in Southern Oregon is infamous, rightly so. But I think the generation of historians that mention violence at all like to pretend that it was all in Southern Oregon, when in fact it was region-wide, right? It was just most infamous in Southern Oregon.
Yeah, that's a great point. You're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and today we're talking about the not-so-cozy pioneer histories and the historical efforts to cover them up. So I want to go on to another phrase that I love, which is the settler colonial sin eater. And I promise I always give credit to you when I talk about these ideas, but this has really resonated with my work in the Chinese diaspora because it's, I've thought about it as a means to kind of explain the prevalence of these massacre myths about Chinese American workers that were blown up or driven off cliffs. And in fact, we actually had an episode a while back with Anna Maria Spagna about the book Pushed about the topic. But can you speak a little bit about how this character has shown up in your work as like either a literary tool or like a way that myths are generated to kind of rationalize some of this violence?
Sure. So on the basic level, settler colonial sin eaters are those that are being used to kind of as the magnet for any violence that you don't want society as a whole to be responsible for. So I use it particularly when I'm talking about those historians who couldn't quite get rid of the horrors of settler colonial violence, who couldn't quite get rid of acts of genocide in places like Southern Oregon. If they couldn't just not talk about it, they would blame it on the fringe, right? They would say there was this violence, yes, but it was from outsiders. It was from unemployed gold miners. In kind of one of the famous incidents I talk about, the Little Butte Creek or Lupton Massacre, James Lupton was a recently elected territorial delegate when he did horrible violence against his indigenous neighbors. And the first generation of historians often said, oh, he's an itinerant cat, right? He's not one of us. So it's a way of keeping that cozy pioneer history dream alive, even when you have to deal with all this violence, right? And making the violence something that only low-class other people do. And I would say we haven't quite stopped doing this as a culture, right? That's still often the instinct when we talk about this kind of violence is to isolate it to a few individuals, again, especially gold miners, and try and keep it away from everyday pioneer life.
Yeah, that is such a good point. And it kind of makes me think, too, about some of the work of a historian, Beth Lou Williams, who's written a lot about exploring Chinese anti-Chinese violence and legislation during exclusion, and how it's often been downplayed or framed. And she really, you know, speaks about the difficulties of threading the needle between you don't want to create victim narratives and you also want to avoid voyeurism. But it's also really difficult to, like, how to frame the realities of the past. So, you know, with all these competing things that you have to unpack, how, you know, what's your approach when you're working with this difficult or dark history? Like, how are you navigating all of this?
Yeah, so I think one element of that is remembering the humanity and complexity of everyone without losing track of the evils and wrongs being done, right? So I think, you know, there's one of the responses sometimes when I speak to the horrors of pioneer culture is people say pioneers were human. And I say, yes, absolutely they are. Almost every monster in history was human, right? And so, yes, they're complex and they have hopes and dreams and they tuck their kids into bed at night and also many of them after support in these atrocious ways. I'd also say that for people who are targeted by this violence, and I use the term victim occasionally, even though it's got its flaws, right? There's a deep problem if you flatten people to just the worst thing that happened. Obviously, you don't want to do that to any people or any culture or any group. But I think of the term victim in terms of crime, right? People are victims in the sense that they were victimized, right? Where I use it is to make sure that we don't lose track of the actions and harms of victimizers. And I think particularly I want to make sure that we don't end up with a world where only the exceptions are named, right? Where we only tell the stories of heroes and we let the harms that were done by those who did the victimizing kind of pass into obscurity and anonymity.
Yeah, yeah. And kind of building off some of that, our students recently had a discussion about the idea of an archaeology of hauntology, not about ghosts in the traditional sense, but about how some of the experiences and events can be so traumatic and so violent in the past that they really can haunt the present, both the people who lived through these events, but also the ways in which people are left to rationalize or process or even interpret them. And this book is so haunted in that sense. And it's hard to read in some regards. And I'm wondering, how was it to write, to really have to sit with and to bear witness to all of this violence and trauma?
I mean, it's a lot. I'll be honest about, you know, this book took over a decade and there were some sleepless nights and pretty hard days in the archive. I also would say, you know, I have friends who work on sexual assault hotlines. My job is easy in that way, right? The villains I read about and talk about are gone. But I think there is a sense of mission here that really can carry you through, right? That both that I need to honor particularly the indigenous voices I found hidden in archives that had been suppressed by previous generations of historians, but also that, I'll be frank, I needed to get some of these villains, right? I needed to make sure that even if they didn't face justice in life, they would face some measure of justice in death. I sometimes say victors only get to write the first draft of history, right? We can write subsequent drafts later.
Oh, I like that. I like that. And I want to kind of like round up or wrap up this conversation by thinking about this is 2026 is the semi-sesquicentennial, the America's 250th anniversary. And we're seeing a lot of efforts to commemorate the history of America everywhere. And some of it is just like the patriotic whatever, you know, that some of us are working to maybe unpack or you know, problematize a little bit more. So how are you thinking about this moment as an opportunity to tell the stories that at one point were not considered worthy to sell?
So I think of this as sort of a moment to commemorate the need for moral revolution, right? That there are really good elements that we're celebrating 250 years later. There are elements of some of those messages. I think of it as a deeply unfinished revolution, right? In some spaces, to mark that we have come pretty far from a lot of the norms and assumptions of the period, right? How many Americans are comfortable with genocide is a much smaller percentage than it was when the country was founded. I would like it to be lower, but it's a much smaller percentage, and also as a marker of just how much further we need to go, right? I see the core goal of history, and I would argue patriotism, as making tomorrow better than yesterday.
Yeah, yeah. And so people can pick up your book, The War on Illahi, and any of their favorite independent bookstores, but it's also now available as an audiobook, right?
Yes, I've got a wonderful voice actor named Rick Adamson. It's released by Panther Media. It's available in all the usual audiobook places. Oh, just came out this month.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much, Mark. It's always awesome to talk to you. I look forward to future chats and collaborations about your work. And that wraps up this round of Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose. Our show producers are Natalie Golay, and you can find this episode and more wherever you get your podcasts.